This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. We're here on Saturdays. We talk about the disease of addiction and the road to recovery. It's much in the news. I needn't tell you that. What we like to do, in addition to tell you all that's going on with regards to treatment, we like to bring you first-person accounts of success. It's very important. A reminder that Recovery Radio is sponsored by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. As I said, it's much in the news. We all know what's going on regarding, well, the opioid epidemic and drug and alcohol abuse in general. It is a plague. There is another story that often goes less reported or underreported, and that is that millions and millions of people manage to get sober and live successful long-term lives in sobriety. We desperately need to remind people that that's possible in spite of how difficult this disease can be. So from time to time, we bring in folks who are on that path. They're on the path to recovery and let you know what their experience is, and maybe you can gain something from it. We find that these first-person accounts have some power, perhaps to inspire somebody who's listening. So that's what we're going to be talking about today with our guest, Adam Warlow. Adam's been on the program before. I apologize, Adam, for not remembering that. Talked to a lot of people. Adam is a 21-year-old fellow. He is now, did you say 15 months?
Just under 15 months.
Just under 15 months of sobriety, and he's here to talk to us about his abuse of drugs and alcohol and how he managed to achieve 15 months of sobriety. So we welcome Adam Warlow back to the program. How are you?
Good. How are you?
It's terrific. How long ago were you here?
About 6 months ago.
Oh, great. So you put another 8 months of successful sobriety under your belt. Refresh our memories. We like to begin at the beginning. You know, who are you, where are you from, and that story.
All right. So, again, my name's Adam Warlow. I grew up in Lebanon County, Pennsylvania. Loving family, mom, dad, three sisters. So, like, I had everything I always needed, you know, and pretty much everything I ever wanted. For a long time, though, I would hang out with, you know, make-believe people. You know, it was easier that way, you know. And then when I got into school, I didn't fit in. I felt insufficient, you know. I did not feel like the other people looked. So there was always felt not sufficient, you know.
Would you, Adam, when you say make-believe people, you
like
mean
imaginary.
Actually imaginary people?
Yeah,
that's something that goes on with most kids when they're very little. How long were you talking to people who weren't there?
Probably until I was like 7 or 8 years old.
Okay.
You know, I found more comfort with imaginary friends than I did with real friends. Yeah. You know, I have a hard time connecting to people because I always felt I was different.
Right.
You know?
You're the first person to mention that there's a relationship between that kind of common childhood thing of imaginary friends and connecting it to that sense of not fitting in. Was it ever identified by anybody when you were a youngster as a problem, or was it just childish behavior?
My parents identified it. They did not seek help until later on, and I sought help through counseling, through anger management. That's what I was told. And to be quite frank with you, I never told the truth with them, you know.
Right.
I lied the whole time. Right. So.
So this feeling, and it's vague. It's always vague. I've heard these stories before, but they have common themes in them. And this thing about growing up having a vague notion that you don't fit and everybody else is different. Can you describe that? When did it begin for real for you? I know it probably was always there, but when did it start to become uncomfortable for you?
My world opened up when I joined elementary school and saw how dark the world could be. You know, I got picked on a lot, and it's all about perception. My perception of the world was very dark. So right away, I was not happy in life, and then also feeling insufficient. There was no happiness. You know, I tried to put on a good front, and like I tried to make friends again, got bullied a lot, and just saw the world as really dark, and that's where the beginning took me. And I was, you know, depressed as a child and felt like I was different the whole time. I couldn't fit in. You know, I got picked on, you know. Couldn't relate to people. I can't connect to people on a very good level, you know. And I was like a chameleon. I was trying to fit in. That's all I wanted to do. I wanted to fit in. I wanted to look like, I wanted to feel how everyone else looked. And that impulse drove me all throughout middle school and pretty much right up until high school.
So you were, you didn't fit, you felt you were different than they were, and you looked to emulate other, were you always looking at other people saying, I'll behave like that and then I'll be okay?
I want to be like that.
Right.
I am desperate. You see how many people they talk to, how many friends they have. I am desperate for that. I have no idea how to achieve it, so I copy them.
Yeah. You know what's interesting about that? It's fascinating because you, at some point, the people that you chose to emulate were abusing drugs and alcohol, right?
Yes, eventually.
You didn't initially begin that way. You looked for positive role models to emulate, correct?
I did. I had a false perception of who...
Who
was,
you
like,
should
my
be.
My idols were, right. You know?
So why didn't that work for you? Why didn't you find the cool kids in school who weren't, you know, abusing drugs and alcohol and just emulate them?
Because we always did what the crowd did, you know. Those were the cool kids. Everyone looked up to them. Everyone knew those were the cool kids. The kids that were doing really well in school and, like, really progressing were nerds, you know what I mean?
Right.
And, like, I fit in both places. I got very good grades, but I wanted to be like them, and they didn't give a shit about anything, you know. So my whole attitude started to change, you know.
Right. So at what point did you start experimenting with I guess that start with alcohol or marijuana?
Actually, it is alcohol. Mm-hmm. In fifth grade, it was a graduation party pretty much to go to middle school, and it was with all the kids that I thought were really cool. And we snuck into his father's fridge, and we cracked open a beer. I remember the first taste of it. I spit it out right away. It was awful. But the other guys were drinking it, and I wanted to be like them, so I drank it. And I liked the feeling it produced. I felt like my mind was quiet, you know?
Yeah. How old were you at that point?
Probably 8 or 9, maybe 10.
Yeah. Again, you've described something that is almost a rite of passage, almost universally experienced at some point for young people. When did it cease to be that and become something else right away? Did it happen right away that you began abusing alcohol?
I don't think I realized it at the time. Later on, it definitely progressed to that. I was chasing a feeling to be like them, but also my head is racing the whole time because I'm constantly thinking, what are they thinking about me? I'm trying to control everything. So my mind is running crazy. But when I put a substance into my body, those voices in my head are quieted.
How about your siblings? You say you had three sisters?
Yes.
Were they okay, or were they having struggles as well? How was it at home?
My oldest sister went off to college when I was in elementary school, and my other sister was getting in trouble, DUIs, stuff like that. And then I have my twin sister who was doing absolutely great in school, getting good grades, all honors, you know, not doing any bad things. So the golden child, I'm the black sheep. You know?
Yeah. Was there any other abuse of drugs or alcohol? Mom, dad, anybody else in the family you were aware of as a youngster?
No. My father had a beer a year, and my mom would enjoy a sangria every once in a while.
Yeah, it's a complete – this is one of the the scariest aspects of the disease of addiction, the randomness of it. Yeah, there are plenty of examples of it running in families, and then there are other examples of – you know, why was your sister okay and you were not? So take me through your high school years. I guess there's a lot of trouble and...
Yeah. In the beginning, I want to start with opiates because I was progressing. I was smoking marijuana. Again, I was chasing that feeling. I got my wisdom teeth out and they prescribed me oxycodones. And my mom was distributing them to me and I pocketed them. And I took 5 at one point.
Well, before that, because again, that's mm-hmm. this is a story we've heard many, many times. It begins with a prescription. You were abusing alcohol before that and marijuana, I guess. You were getting high, right?
I was getting high, okay. Yes. I was getting out of myself.
So when you take your first Oxycontin for the pain of the surgery,
mm-hmm.
did you get high on it immediately? Did you like the way it felt?
Yes, and I wanted more. It wasn't, you know, one dose wasn't enough.
Right, and it's interesting because there's your teeth, and you're probably uncomfortable, and somebody gives you a painkiller. But when you are addicted, when you have this disease, you sort of go right past the painkiller effect of it, mm-hmm. and you're right to the high. Is that it?
Yeah, I'm looking for the euphoria.
For people who don't get it, they just go, "How's that possible?" I mean, I've taken painkillers, and I'm glad for the pain relief, but you went right to the high.
Yeah, and I envy those people. You know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, they're not allergic.
Yep.
to opiates.
Yeah, we have allergic
reaction. It's an allergic reaction to this drug. So now you want it, and take me through. And you're a young high school student. Yeah. Are other people doing opiates at that point?
Let me finish with that. That was the first time I put opiates into my body, and instantly I knew that was the solution. You know, I loved marijuana, I love alcohol, I love LSD, I like cocaine, I like a lot of drugs, but that was it. So throughout high school, I was chasing that, and it was hard at the time because doctors started getting locked up. Prescriptions were harder to get at the time, you know. So I would get it every once in a while. A couple of my friends, yes, they were abusing them. My drug use really progressed when I started getting into the workforce. I started working at Texas Roadhouse in my hometown. And I worked in the kitchen. We were doing lines of cocaine off the line while we were cooking. Like, it was crazy. Everyone was doing drugs. And that's when someone introduced heroin to me. And ever since then, I fell in love with it.
How did you first take the heroin? Did you shoot it up immediately, or did you?
No, I snorted it in my buddy's car.
Yeah,
you know.
And this progression is again kind of what you hear. What was it about opiates that you preferred over anything else that you were sort of medicating yourself with?
It was the best at quieting my head. It made me feel like how I was supposed to be. I felt like it made me act like how I'm supposed to be. That is the person I'm supposed to be, is when I'm high. I did heroin. And for a long time, I was against heroin because I was under the false illusion. If I just do OxyContin or Percocet, I'm not that bad. And a couple war stories later, it was just another opiate. Mm-hmm. You know, if I sniff it, I'm not that bad. I'm under that false illusion the whole time that I don't have a problem.
Keep making deals with yourself.
I am recreationally snorting heroin. Like, that's a normal thing
in
my head, which is crazy.
Right, but I'm not like those guys.
Yeah, I'm really not like those guys. I don't have a problem.
All right, we're back on Recovery Radio. Steve Martorana with you. Our guest in the studio is Adam Warlow. Adam's 21 years old. Adam's been on the program. He's part of our alumni group. We bring in folks who have been through treatment at retreat and other places, and who are now engaged in successful sobriety. Adam's 15 months, going on 15 months sobriety, and he's sharing with us his story of substance abuse. So now you're a full blown addict. You're shooting heroin. How serious was your? Somebody forgot to turn their phone off. Anyway, how serious was your habit in high school?
It progressed, again, but you said I had a problem. I was a full-blown addict. I did not believe that.
Yeah.
There was
mm-hmm.
no way I was
mm-hmm.
like that, you know. I was medicating because there was something wrong with me, and that's the way I perceived it, you know what I mean? The use progressed through working, and I started having bad work ethic, you know. I started showing up late, taking breaks whenever I wanted, and the bosses caught on, and eventually my father found a straw that I was snorting with, and he said he's going to test it. He's like, are you doing cocaine? I'm like, no, I'm not doing cocaine. You can drug test me, you know. I was hoping to call his bluff. Well, he drug tested me, and I told him everything. You know, I've been using heroin, and at that point, it was getting pretty miserable because I'm waking up sick every day.
Well, let me back you up a second. Mm-hmm. Had you had problems with abusing either alcohol or lesser drugs prior to this that made your father suspicious, or was it just that straw that triggered it for him?
In the past, he has been suspicious of me using drugs all the time.
So he had reason to believe you were messing around.
Yeah, without a doubt. I'm not very good at cleaning up after myself.
Okay,
you know?
Okay.
So, I mean, all throughout high school, that's all I looked forward to. You know what I mean? Getting high. That's it. And coming to school drunk, just waiting to get high.
What were the consequences of that for your high school career? What kind of a high school kid were you?
I was not a very good kid. I like to talk back a lot. I was suspended a lot. The most trouble I've gotten in is from truancy, mm-hmm. just leaving school. I probably left school at least 30 times my junior year, just left, got in my car, and
took off. You graduated?
I did graduate, yeah, okay. Yes.
So dad drug tests you, it comes back positive for opiates, and then what happens?
This is about 4 months into using heroin, and at that point I'm still in love with it. And the repercussions suck because I'm getting sick all the time, you know, and I'm getting miserable about that. I blew through about $3,000 in 2 months you know.
Is it savings you had from work? Or
that is savings I had from work. Yep. I'm not meeting any of my requirements. I'm not making car payments anymore. I'm living rent-free now with my parents. I should be paying them. My job growth is being diminished. You know, my bosses don't look up to me anymore. They know I have a problem. In fact, I found out later, actually this year, that my boss was actually in AA. So he understood. He was trying to reach out and help me out the whole time. And basically said, you know, get out of here.
Wasn't working. You know, when you started using heroin or opiates, you said that it put you in the place you thought you were looking for.
Yeah, it made me.
Right, you felt okay about it.
Yes.
How did you feel about it now? Were you able to go, you know what, this stuff is not making me feel good anymore?
I needed the euphoria back then. I felt empty inside, you know. I felt empty inside, and I needed something to fill that.
So all of the consequences of this, the blown money, the disappointment, your parents must have been freaked out, your job performance, your bills piling up, didn't matter as long as you could get that high.
Yes, because I'm not okay with myself. I didn't – like, I can lose all that stuff, but if I'm not okay with myself, nothing else matters, you know. It became a full-time job, planning to get drugs. Any other plans were out the window.
Yeah, where you – so – this is going to sound like a strange question. Characterize your mood. Were you okay with this? Were you depressed with this? Were you able to go, gee, this is a mess, but I got to stay high?
I would have false moments of clarity. You know, when I was sober.
When you could see what was going on.
Yeah. And I wouldn't say false. Sorry. I had moments of clarity and realized, like, this is not how I want to do this. It's not how I want to live. Like, this is miserable. I'm working to get high and getting high to work.
Right, right. Let me know about some of the other consequences. What was your health like in those days? What were your relationships with other people? Were they like?
Yeah, my relationship with my father kept getting worse and worse. No trust. As in girlfriends in the past, they didn't trust me. And quite frankly, I didn't care about anything. So, like, I didn't care about harming people because I never think about how my actions are affecting anyone else, because all I think about is myself and how to get mine.
The only relationship you had was with this drug?
Basically, yes.
Is that the way it works?
Yeah. I mean, I've had relationships, but they were put on the sideline, you know? I got one player, and that's my drugs.
At its worst, how much heroin were you using?
A good day would be over a bundle a day.
A bundle is
10 bags. I mean,
10 bags.
Yeah, a good day is about 15 bags. That's a great day.
How, for people who don't know, how often do you have to inject that much heroin? How many times a day?
Originally, when I was sniffing it, I would be okay. I wouldn't get sick for at least a day or two. And it progressed to the point where I'm getting sick. I switched to needle because I'm snorting 8 bags. I'm not producing the feeling that I once felt. So I started shooting it. But the euphoria only lasts about an hour, and I will be sick within 4 hours.
It never occurs to you at that point that you are – the reason you began using this drug has now changed. Mm-hmm. And now you're using it because you don't want to get sick.
Yep.
That never occurs. Well, obviously, it has to occur to you on some level, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't strike you as odd or wrong.
No, at the time it didn't.
Yeah. Did you overdose? Did you ever overdose?
Before I was doing heroin, it was my birthday, and my buddy gave me 3 oxycodone 10s, and I took that. And then I drank about 6 beers, and I fell out, and my buddies threw me in a cold shower because they were scared. They didn't want to call the police. And that was the closest I've ever been to death. I was very pale. I couldn't see. You know, I passed out. Woke up freezing in a cold shower, you know.
Adam Warlow sharing with us his story of struggles with alcohol and heroin. And when we come back, we'll continue his story about how he gets to that moment where he realizes this is not going to work any longer. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I'm Steve Martirano. Recovery Radio is sponsored each and every week by Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. I want to give you their phone number for a couple of reasons. First, and yes, most obviously, is that they are an absolute world-class organization. You could do no better than to get the treatment you need from a place like Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. They are justifiably proud of what they have accomplished and what they provide, and their reputation is well known. But they give you they want me to give you the phone number as an informational item. Peter Shore, who's the founder and CEO of this, says, yeah, we're paying the freight there, but this isn't a commercial. If we can help people, we will, anyway, at all, either with our people and our facilities and our techniques, or we'll give them information where that maybe they can get the help they need. So that's the spirit in which we give you the phone number for Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. If you have any questions about anything regarding this disease or anything you've heard on the program, they will answer them for you. 855-859-8808. That's the phone number for Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, 855-859-8808. Our guest in the studio is Adam Warlow. Adam's a young fellow, 21 years old, but even in that short period of time has managed to get himself in pretty deep trouble because of the disease of addiction. He is now 15 months sober, and he's sharing with us his journey to that point in time. So, we, you know, Adam, I always say on the program that all stories of abuse and recovery are the same, except they're different.
Yeah.
it's always true in my mind. Another thing that's always the same but different is that moment when somebody caught up in this goes, this isn't working anymore. Tell me about that time, the first time that happened for you.
Well, I talked about before when I was younger, my perception of the world was really dark, and the drugs used to make my perception better, you know, whether it be heroin, oxy, alcohol, anything. And my perception used to be, it used to get better. You know, I used to see the world like, wow, this is how I want the world to be all the time. And it got to the point where it didn't do that for me anymore, where I was still upset, still hated the world. Because it's all about my perception. I saw the world as a dark place, that there's no point in life. Life is meaningless. We're here to reproduce and then die. You know, there's absolutely no point. There's no God, you know. And if there is one, he hates me, you know, because he's not working in my life.
So it's getting dark. It's really dark now.
It's getting morbidly dark, yes.
You mentioned that darkness as a youngster, though, this sort of sense of that you didn't fit and that you didn't know how to act, and it was a kind of grim and depressing vision. Now you've used drugs to try to escape that. It's no longer working. Are you at any point where you worried about hurting yourself just to escape all that pain? Did you ever have those thoughts?
Yeah, there was a point I did try killing myself.
Is that right?
Yes. I hooked up a hose to my car and tried to gas myself. My dad pulled me out of the car. That's why I went to my first psych ward. I went to Philhaven. And that was an interesting experience. I didn't want to be there because, again, they find out I'm a drug addict. They're not giving me any meds anymore. You know, I'm withdrawing. And it was miserable. You know, I tried taking my life. There comes a point where you don't want to live anymore, but you're afraid to die. And that's where I was at, you know. I tried. I don't want to go on, but, you know, I'm too scared to kill myself. I tried. It didn't work, you know. So, like, I didn't know what to do. I felt hopeless. And the emptiness had returned,
right,
with or without the drugs.
Yeah, and suicide seemed logical or the only escape.
It sounded silenced.
The only way.
Like, it sounded like I could silence it for good. You know, all the racing thoughts in my head all the time, the drugs weren't stopping it. So I needed a new solution.
Yeah, yeah. How long were you in the psych ward?
About a week.
Did that get your attention?
The last 4 months of using, you know, I was very fully aware I had a problem and just didn't know what to do about it, and scared of change, you know. I'm feared up. I don't know what to do. You know, I've been to multiple rehabs at that point, and nothing was working. I wasn't trying anything, you know. I could manage to pull maybe 2 months together, and then I'd rationalize in my head, I have back pain, so I need Vicodin. Well, I'd go out looking for Vicodin, I can't find it, so I'll use heroin. Use heroin for, you know, 1, 2, 3 days, take Suboxone, taper off. And that's what I did, just repeat cycle. And just working, doing nothing, not progressing. Just, again, felt life was meaningless because I'm working to get high and get high to work. It's terrible.
Right. During your, you say, 4 times in and out of rehab?
Mm-hmm.
The first bunch of times when it wasn't working, were they residential treatment programs you were in?
Yes.
Were you undergoing detox every time?
Yes.
Yeah. And still getting high during the treatment?
I would get high off the subs. But I would be dry in there, and I'd be really, really miserable. And I saw all these people that looked really rough. I couldn't even look in the mirror. I don't know how rough I looked, you know. But I see these people, I'm like, I'm not like them.
You're still at that point where you're separating yourself from.
Yeah, I'm different. you know, I'm special. Like, I am somebody. You guys should know who I am, you know. I'm under the false illusion. I have a huge ego, but I'm so insecure and scared of what everybody thinks, so I put up that false illusion.
Well, it's also terrifying to look at somebody else in the same trouble you're in and admit that you're that person. It's important to get to that point, right?
Yeah, I got to break down my ego. That's all what it's all about. My ego is what stops me from getting sober. My ego is what stops me from being of service to other people. My ego is what kept me sick for so long, you know.
So I know that you wound up at retreat, the program sticks with you at that point. Why didn't it earlier? Because you hadn't gotten to the point where you had to accept certain truths about yourself?
Yeah, I wasn't ready to accept it. The hardest thing to admit was what was going to set me free. I am an alcoholic who suffers – or I am a heroin addict who suffers from alcoholism. And that was the hardest thing to swallow. But once I was able to say that, it freed me, you know.
Was there a person or an event or was it an accumulation of things that got you to that point where you had to be honest?
I just hated going through life in that cycle. It came to a point, again, my dad wanted to drug test me because I stole a bunch of money out of his safe. And he's like, I know you're using heroin again. And I had clean urine on me ready for a drug test, you know. And we talked about it for about 5 minutes. He's like, all right, well, you're going to have to pee. I'm like, save the drug test I'm using. And like, he didn't believe me, but yeah, I had pee ready to go. You know, I could have passed that test, but I didn't want to, man. I didn't know what to do. I was like, I can't go on like this. It's miserable and I want to die. I feel dead inside. I just want to die, you know?
And you asked to go back to treatment again. And after, this is the fourth time.
I pretty much begged. You know, he used to go throw me out on the street. He was actually going to press charges against me, but my sister's convinced him not to.
For stealing the money?
For stealing the money, yeah. It was over $3,000.
Well, he's done enabling at this point.
Yes.
But he hasn't given up, right? He hasn't given up on you? Or do you think he had?
He was very angry that night. He definitely gave up that night. But the next morning, he was out looking on the computer for rehabs while I'm withdrawing, laying on the bathroom floor, like pretty much dying. I could have went out, but like I was trying to prove to him, like I do.
You're worth want another
it.
Shot. Yeah.
I want it. I want it so bad.
Yeah, when people tell me about multiple relapses and multiple trips to treatment and others don't understand, they go, oh, it doesn't work. I'm always struck by the fact that you guys keep trying. You keep trying. Did you recognize that if you didn't keep trying treatment that you were going to die?
Yeah, I knew at some point I was going to die, whether I take my own life or the drugs killed me. And I, at some, one point, like, I welcomed that feeling. I was hoping that would happen. When I would nod out, I'd wake up after I black out, and I'm angry that I didn't die, you know. So it definitely got to that point.
Yeah. When you got to retreat, did Dad take you? How did you physically get here?
Yeah, my father drove me. This is about 2 days in, and I'm withdrawing in the car, and I get there, and we talk for a little bit. He drops me off, gives me a hug, and I broke down crying. That was the first time I probably cried in about 5 years. You know,
what was Mom going through during this whole process?
My mom really keeps to herself and lets my dad speak through her. She was crying; she was in tears, and that's what also helped me go to rehab. You know, I didn't have the right to hurt them anymore because they've done nothing but love me, and I can't produce harm anymore because it's killing me now. But again, there's no relief of anything at this point. I'm empty inside, and now I'm hurting the people that love me unconditionally. I can't do it.
And this is, what, you're 20? You're not even 20 yet.
I am 20. At this point, I'm 20.
You're 20 years old. In this final stint in rehab, how did you see things differently than the other? I mean, you've explained some of it, but did you have a better frame of mind, or did things start to fall away that you could no longer force yourself to believe?
I was ready to do anything. I didn't know what I was doing. And, like, I saw a lot of hope in those rooms. I heard a lot of stories that were a lot worse than mine, and these people are here recovering and they want it. And it inspired me, you know? I always thought I was different. I could relate to these people. I'm like, how? They're telling their story. I'm like, how does this guy know me? He's telling my story. You know, he describes the feelings. I feel the exact same way.
So for the first time, you were able to see that you had something in common with these people rather than try to separate yourself from them.
Yes, this is the first time.
I'm always struck by how hard people work at staying high. I mean, you talked about having clean urine to cover up a drug tab. I mean, it's a full-time job to stay high.
Yeah, we were stealing from stores. We were getting gift cards. Like, you name it, we've done
right,
it.
Right,
you know?
Right. And to what extent did you then apply that work ethic to staying to getting sober? I mean, it takes work to do this, right?
It definitely takes work. It definitely takes work. A lot of hard work, too, and you got to be willing to do it. And, again, I was just willing to do anything because I couldn't go on because, like, again, I couldn't imagine myself staying alive, you know what I mean? Like, I'd rather die. I was scared to take my own life, but I don't want to live anymore. So what do I do?
But that's a bad spot to be in.
Yeah. So I was basically like a little kid. I needed directions. That's all I need. Just give me directions. Make your bed. I made my bed. Anything to stay sober. You told me to dig a 6-foot hole in the backyard. That'll keep me sober. You know, I'd dig it right away, you know?
You had tried everything you thought worked. It didn't. So now why not try something else?
Yeah. My idea has always got me high.
Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I'm Steve Martyr, and I want to thank our guest, Adam Warlow. Adam's been with us this hour talking about his struggles with drugs and alcohol and his road to sobriety. We began the program by telling you that all of the news that we hear about the disease of addiction is overwhelmingly grim, and that's for obvious reasons. It's a grim disease, devastates lives, kills people, destroys families. Yeah, it's a bad, bad disease, but the other side is that many people, millions in fact, can manage long-term successful sobriety, and Adam is one in and out of rehab before the age of 21. He's now achieved 15 months of sobriety, and he's sharing with us his story. So as hard a life that one leads in the grip of this disease, There's an even greater task and maybe even a harder task ahead, and that's being sober.
Mm-hmm.
That's being sober. Take us through sober living for you. When you left retreat after the last time in treatment, did you go into a sober living facility, or take us through that process?
Yeah, I wanted to go home because that was my best idea. But again, at that point, I was willing to do anything. People can make decisions for me. They said, "Hey, you're going here." And I had to accept that. The whole thing was acceptance. You know, I had to accept that I'm a drug addict. I had to accept I'm going to rehab. I got to accept I'm never going home again. You know, I'm going to sober living.
But that wasn't your initial – your impulse would have been just to go back to your regular life because you're probably okay now.
Yeah, because right. I got separated from the drug. I thought I was okay. I never realized the problem was with me, you know. There's always a pattern. Doesn't matter where I go, the problem still follows me.
So even at that point, mm-hmm. you still – weren't aware that maybe you weren't the best person to listen to under these circumstances.
Yeah.
But you did.
Yep.
All right. Tell us about sober living facility.
You know, the beginning, early recovery nonsense. You know, I didn't know what I was doing. I got a sponsor right away, and he didn't necessarily have a lot of time. He was actually dying of cancer. So I got recommended to a new sponsor, and he started taking me through the steps and letting me know that I am very self-centered, and I'm my favorite subject, and that's my problem is I think about myself too much, you know? We start going through the steps. We start cleaning house, you know? Identified all the people that I've harmed, and I go make amends to them. I make right by the situations, which is a beautiful feeling, you know, and we keep moving on. And at that point
– Had you had any experience with the 12 steps prior during your other stints in rehab?
Yeah, I read them. You know, I saw God, and I was like, get out of here. I don't know what you're talking about. You know what I mean? I've been to church. It doesn't work, you know? And I was under that false illusion of a higher power. It has to be Jesus, you know what I mean? And that's what pulled me away from the 12 steps for so long. And, you know, I didn't believe in God when I first started doing the steps at all. And I talk to a lot of my guys now because I'm actually a house manager, and they struggle from the same thing. I let them know that I found God through the steps. I didn't find God, you know, before the steps. I found him working the steps. I found him working in my life, you know. He kept my spirit alive long enough for me to fall into AA.
That moment when you're confronted with the higher power concept here in AA, and as you say, you had rejected it in the past, and it, in fact, you recoiled from it. What changed this time? Was it more a case of, you know, the bright light and now I get it, or just, look, I'm not even going to concern myself with what this means. I'm just going to do this and see what happens.
Yeah, it is exactly like that. And then I did have a white light experience.
Did you really?
With my fifth step, yes. And I don't have those very often. I have more of the educational variety with spiritual terms. You know what I mean? I see God working in my life all the time in little ways. You know, I had a small white light experience, and that was the only one I had with the fifth step. I sat and meditated with God, and I realized God was with me the whole time in my life, pulling me along. He put me through what I had to go through to be ready to accept Him and find Him.
Tell us other problems. Young people in early sobriety is very difficult. If you're a little older, it may be a little easier to cut yourself off from what's going on in society, but it's a little more difficult for a young guy, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I was put on this earth for one reason. That's to make more of me, you know? So in early recovery, we feel this emptiness inside because the drugs are gone, and that's what filled our void the whole time. So we try and fill it with other things, you know? Whether we go out to eat all the time, you find a new girlfriend in early recovery, or you get a new car, you get new shoes, you get new tattoos. All these things make you feel good for a little amount of time, but they don't keep it. You know, it's false higher power. I can make a girl my higher power. I've done it before. And it doesn't work. I get miserable, and somebody goes out because of it, you know, and I don't have the right to do that. Early recovery, I don't recommend relationships, but I get it. I did it, you know. I did. I completely understand it. It's just – it's hard. We need to fill the void, and I fill the void with God. God fills me.
Finally here, this may seem trite, but what other gifts are there about being sober?
One, not waking up sick every day, man, which is a beautiful feeling. But having a sense of purpose, and the biggest gift of all is a new perception, and the psyche change. You know, I don't see the world as a dark place anymore, and I don't see everyone as selfish beings. You know, I'm put on this earth for one reason, and that's to help my brother. You know, we're all people, and we need to help each other and love each other.
And what's changed about the way you feel about yourself?
I've accepted that I had a problem, and I was sick. I was spiritually sick. And so I don't forget the past, but I don't let it dawn on me. I keep moving, and I remember what happened, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I just keep moving, and I feel good with myself because I'm spiritually filled. Well, that void is filled, and my perception is beautiful.
Yeah, so now it's okay to feel good about you.
Yes.
Right. Do you ever look back at that and go, how did that happen? How did all of this happen? I can't believe it.
It happened because it was supposed to happen, you know? And that's the way I feel about it.
Well, Adam, thanks so much, and continued success. We appreciate you sharing the story with us.
Thank you.
And we appreciate your time as well, listening to the program. We're here on Saturdays. It's Recovery Radio. Enjoy the rest of the weekend, and look for us next week. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.